This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
The elected leaders of the country have a responsibility to consider all available options, and we are doing so. What we must not do in the face of a mortal threat is to give in to wishful thinking or to willful blindness. We must not simply look away, hope for the best, and leave the matter for some future administration to resolve.
Vice President Dick Cheney speaking Thursday to Korean War veterans about the Bush administration's case for military action against Iraq. Birthday boy Dan Shore is away this weekend, so we're pleased to be joined by NPR's senior national correspondent, Linda Wertheimer. Linda, nice to have you back.
Thank you very much, Scott.
The Vice President made a couple of speeches this week to present arguments in favor of military intervention. Your judgment, how have those speeches perceptibly strengthened the administration's case, either in Congress or with the public?
Well, I think what he's basically said is that a unilateral strike against Iraq's leader is appropriate because to wait is too dangerous. And he has gone beyond that in a second speech to say that weapons inspections didn't work and resuming them would only offer false security. He says that the United States has to look at the possibility that Saddam Hussein will use weapons of mass destruction against this country or its allies. And basically, Cheney says, get to him before he gets any more dangerous. If we could have preempted 9/11, which I think was one of the more compelling things he said, we would have. And how credible a case is that? It's based on intelligence to which we're not privy. People who have been briefed seem genuinely shaken by what they've heard. I guess the real answer is, I don't know.
What's your feeling for why the Vice President made this representation this week and so far not President Bush in this detailed way?
It's the job of the Vice President, of course, to do the unpleasant things. I mean, usually that runs to funerals and trips to visit less important heads of state. But in this administration, the Vice President gets this job of bringing the bad news that American leaders think the war is inevitable and necessary. And I'd say really for two reasons, maybe two and a half reasons. First, because the president will speak out on the anniversary of the terrorist attack, and his advisors, I think, will very likely want to him to save his breath for that occasion. It will be the most important speech he's made in many months, and the whole world will be listening to what he says in that time period. Secondly, the vice president is clearing the way for Mr. Bush. He's saying the words first. He's raising the specter of war. He's drawing the comment and concern from world leaders and critics in this country against saving the president. And I think, not to be overlooked, the vice president is a very serious person. He was brought into the administration to lend his experience and power to a Texas governor untried in international affairs. I think he brings considerable weight to any policy discussion. And I think, you know, although the most important reasons he's gone first are political, it's also true that policymakers and people in general take him seriously, very seriously.
Maybe we need to sharpen our mind at the same time with the political question. The Bush administration says it might seek explicit congressional support before moving on to Iraq, but not necessarily a formal vote. If there were to be a vote, any doubt in your mind how that would go?
No. My expectation is that the president will ask or consult or do something to reach out to Congress before he does anything. And I think the Congress will give him what he wants, because we've seen cautionary flags raised and very appropriately raised in Congress, but I don't see a revolt developing on the Hill.
And traditional U.S. allies abroad?
That's a very much more difficult thing, particularly the Germans and the British, who have political problems with doing it. In Britain, Prime Minister Tony Blair wants to help the president, but he finds the grassroots of his Labour Party are not so willing. The French are publicly critical. The Russians and the Chinese are opposed. The president could obviously go it alone. I mean, this is a superpower, after all. The American people, however, I think, feel more comfortable with a coalition. And the Bush administration is facing dramatic increases in deficits, and that has to be a consideration. The president is going to go to the General Assembly on September 12th, I believe. There may be something happening at the United Nations which would provide a little bit of cover for the allies and allow them to come in.
Pentagon officials said this week they're going to support sending more peacekeepers to Afghanistan. They're not U.S. soldiers. At the same time, they will be supported by U.S. tactical airlift and intelligence assets. How significant a shift is this in policy?
The administration is calling it a mid-course correction. Of course, it means the United States has to provide command and control help to peacekeepers spread around Afghanistan. and stand by to get them out of any bad situation if they have to be rescued. So that means an extended commitment in troops and time and money and a change in the stated policy against nation building. However, since the administration seems prepared to graft a democracy onto Iraq somewhere down the road, maybe the argument that they're not in the business of nation building doesn't have as much salience as it once did.
Washington Post reported this week that the UN draft report says that al-Qaeda's financial network describes it, in fact, as fit and well. U.S. Treasury has challenged some aspects of that report, but does it at the same time disclose something to us about how difficult it is to shut up a far-flung, international, rich terrorist organization?
Absolutely. I mean, apparently, police organizations around the world do have considerable ability to track cash and other fungible documents through banks and businesses that launder money and can potentially close down a lot of that traffic. But they have very little ability to track gemstones or gold or other highly portable, valuable things that can be used to finance terror. But I think the central thing is that despite concerns that al-Qaeda may be large and have cells everywhere, the history of terrorism is a history of small groups of highly dedicated people operating in isolation with intermittent help from some core organization. I think that makes it very difficult for police forces attempting to shut them down.
And does the complexity of the challenge of international terrorism get underscored this week when we learned that the German officials now believe that the plot for September 11th was underway a couple of years before it occurred?
It's frightening, and to think that other groups are out there biding their time, planning and plotting, but we have to accept that that is happening. Apparently, the group at work in Germany boasted about their plans. They left a lot of information around about what they had been doing, but they were not found out.
Moving on, domestically, the FBI is investigating leaks of classified information relating to the attacks a year ago from the Senate Intelligence Committee. Most of the committee members have agreed to provide details about their contacts with journalists. My gosh, how implicating could this be?
Well, you know, to say that they talked to journalists doesn't mean that they told them anything. I mean, I'm not sure that these telephone logs are going to turn up much. Mm-hmm. Reporters ask questions. Sometimes they're answered and sometimes they're not. But besides which, talking to reporters is not a crime. And there have been times in the United States history when leaking information to the public has been a patriotic thing to do. I think one thing...
Just recently.
Something that we in the business of informing the public have to defend.
Let me get you finally to turn your fine political judgment to a couple of issues. Why was there a settlement in the baseball strike?
Well, big-time sports are just not very sympathetic, it seems to me. I mean, the millionaires who play baseball were not sympathetic. The gazillionaires who own baseball really couldn't afford a strike. Their business is just beginning to recover from the last one. So I think they were under tremendous pressure to make an agreement, and they did. And it seems to me that the agreement to share among the rich and poor teams may have the salutary effect that it has had in football, make things more competitive, more interesting.
A reminder that no matter how rich you are, at some point you need public support if you're in that business. Almost shockingly, the Augusta National Golf Club, which hosts the Masters tournament each year, says they're going to give up commercial ads for the tournament in 2003, which means giving up money so that they don't have to admit women as members.
Yes. I must say that I'm torn about this because I think a men-only club like that is something that I don't really approve of. But on the other hand, a commercial-free Masters is something I do approve of.
Okay. Well, you have to live on the edge of ambivalence on that. Okay. Thanks very much, Linda Wertheimer.